Hello and welcome back to Millennial Musings. And as always, I'm your host, Anurag Ramchandran. Today is our 10th episode, and I have a very special guest with me. Somebody that I've looked onto for inspiration ever since I first met him, all the way back in 2012. Peyton Head. Peyton is a one-of-a-kind leader, who during his time as the student body president at the University of Missouri, fought against systemic injustice at the university and ignited the entire student body to fight for a more inclusive campus. In the process, he set about conversations to not just improve race relations in the state, but in the entire country. Currently, Peyton is a student at the University of Chicago, works at the Obama Foundation, and also continues his incredible work talking about social justice issues and making campuses more inclusive throughout the world. It is truly my honor and pleasure to have my good friend Peyton join us for a discussion on leadership and fighting systemic injustice on one of our milestone episodes. So without further ado, let's jump straight in. So Peyton, one of the first things, you know, whenever I think about you, or I'm sure whenever anybody thinks about you, one of the first things that really sticks to us is the fact that you are a natural leader. You just have something about you that's just so caring and empathetic, and at the same time, you just have a sense of where to take people along with you. So I just want to start by asking you, where did it first come to you that, you know, you have this in you, that yes, you are a leader, and that this is something that you can do going into the future?
Ooh, great question. I think one of the biggest lessons I learned in leadership is the importance of communication.
Right.
And I think that a lot of people don't understand that communication is so important to every single thing that we do, because it's the basis of like how we survive and how we work with one another and how we build community. And I learned from a very early age the power of communication. I was privileged enough to be able to have teachers for parents. So my dad was a history teacher, and my mom was an English teacher.
Right.
So being able to understand, you know, context of the world around me and my family, like coming from my father, in addition to being able to learn how to be an effective communicator,
yep,
which I learned from my mom, like who taught English, those skills combined with each other, I think gave me one of the biggest tools that I could use as a leader, and that's to communicate from a place of authenticity, in addition to a place of real cultural and historical context whenever I open my mouth and however I interact with other people. And because of that, I felt like I was grounded in my own story, even though that there were missing pieces along the way.
Right.
But I was grounded enough in my own story to be able to share it and be able to internalize it and to know who I am and whose I am. And that's how I interact with other people. So that was one critical piece of it. I always say the context, like history and communication is important. But more than that, it's compassion that comes from understanding people's experiences.
Mm.
And I believe that you're not going to be able to completely understand every single thing that somebody is going through.
Right.
But by placing yourself in proximity to the issues, you know, relating to different people, I think that you can at least try to develop and foster an understanding of things that you necessarily wouldn't know if you didn't take the time to get to know somebody, or you didn't take the time to volunteer. And those were the ways in which I was able to get to know people, to try to figure out how to become an effective leader. And that was by actually reaching out and speaking to people and seeing what were some of the things that were on their minds as some of the biggest challenges to them living their lives in the way that they truly want to live their lives.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that sticks to me the most when you said about it is being authentic. And I think it's a word that's thrown around quite a bit, especially in leadership circles, especially among people in power or people aspiring for power. It's a word I feel like needs to be grounded back in its actual meaning. And sometimes because of the frequency in which it's used so much, it loses, for lack of a better term, the authenticity of and its meaning. So what I want to know from you is that, what does it mean to be authentic to you? How can someone become authentic, or is someone authentic? And
either way, is it a characteristic of leadership that is absolutely essential in somebody?
Well, the thing is for the second part of that question, I don't think that it's necessarily something that we always see in leadership, right? It may be a character in leadership that is needed, but it's not necessarily something that we always see in our leaders. I think with authenticity, for me, the definition of it, at least the way in which I look at it, is like being real and true to yourself and your truth, and understanding that there are multiple truths and multiple people around you at all times, and their stories are all unique and complex and different. And I think that's what it means to be authentic, is when you can ground yourself in who you are in the midst of all of the changes that are going on around you, and also not being afraid to change as well.
Absolutely.
I think authenticity is difficult. Like you said, it is something that is being thrown around a lot lately. But part of me with understanding authenticity, the way that I look at it, is understanding that nobody is perfect, too.
Yeah.
And I think that when we say we want people to be real and authentic, I think that sometimes gives people this idea that people are automatically, like, if they're going to be real and authentic, they're going to be perfect, they're going to be 100% at all times, they're never going to, like, you know, mess up, or they're never going to disappoint you.
Right.
They're never going to be a person who's going to get canceled, quote unquote. But I think with authenticity, when you can realize that you've made faults, when you realize that, you know, the decisions that you've made in your life have led to where you are today, when you realize that there's no such thing as self-made, that there was always somebody there in some capacity to get you where you are today, I think that's what being authentic is. Is when you can recognize that you can be both a work in progress and a masterpiece at the same time.
Wow,
that's to me.
That is absolutely. I mean, that's put so well. And I think another aspect of you know what you just talked about is, and it sticks out to me, is about compassion. Compassionate leaders, or at least in certain circles, I would say, compassion is seen as a sign of weakness. You know, for the longest time, everyone was talking about how great Steve Jobs is, and the fact that his ruthless nature and the fact that he wasn't the best to others around him was also one of the factors that made him a great leader. And, you know, when I used to go to some of these leadership circles and meetings and gatherings of people, that's another thing that was thrown around, right? Like, you've got to be, I mean, sometimes you've got to make sacrifices, and sometimes you just don't have to care about people if your vision or goal is XYZ. It's not something that I've always agreed with, and it's not something that I agree with, in fact. But what are your thoughts about it? I know there are different kinds of leadership, but I'm also sure, but knowing you, I know that compassion is a central piece in the kind of leader that you are. So if you can talk about compassion a little more.
Yeah, I think compassion can also be one of those words that doesn't necessarily always have a clear definition. The definition kind of depends on who is using it, right? However, with compassionate leadership, I think that it's essential to good leadership, because I think that anybody who's going to be in front of people in any kind of way, anybody who's supposed to be a steward of people or a leader of people, has to understand the stories and at least identify a little bit with some of the struggles and even just the hopes and dreams of the people in which you lead. And I think that is what compassion is kind of all about. Compassion isn't necessarily like bending every single part of your plan for every single person all the time. But I think compassion is getting to a point where you can understand that, like, you know that you won't be able to be everything for everyone.
Right.
But you can at least take the time to learn as many experiences as possible to make sure that you're actually being a representative leader. And I think that compassionate leadership leads to representative leadership. And I think that we have an issue when leaders think that compassion and knowing people's stories and knowing their hopes and dreams and all that kind of stuff isn't important or essential to their leadership. Because just like for me, I think that for any leader, your platform should be one of the people in which, you know, who put you in place
in
to
place,
represent
in,
them.
In the position of power.
Yeah, you're not, I don't think that you should just be, you know, a person who's just like, oh, well, these are my views and everything, and I'm just going to go, and this is the way I want to do it. I think a compassionate leader understands that they need to be more of a microphone and elevate the voices of others who are often unheard. And I think that that is one way to be a compassionate leader. And sometimes that means that you got to put yourself in proximity and you got to take yourself out of some circles in order to get acquainted with people who necessarily wouldn't be in your circle. And when we realize, I mean, that our whole circles and everything are so small, even though they may seem so big to us.
Right.
And we take the time to understand other people's experiences. I think that great leadership can come out of that. Because you can have a completely different perspective in the room when you think about making a decision, as opposed to just saying, these are the only perspectives of the people who I have in this room, and these are the only ones that matter. And I think that's when you have policies and all kind of laws that come out that catch a lot of different communities off guard because they weren't necessarily meant to represent them as well.
So I think another big thing that I wrestle with when it comes to leadership as such is what does it mean to represent somebody? Because what I see is, and especially we're going through the election season right now in India, and a lot of the times the loudest voices are sometimes taken to be the best leaders, and it's deeply problematic because behind those loud voices you often miss the fact that sometimes the policy isn't strong, or in other cases, they aren't representing people. They're representing an agenda that is their own. But what does it actually mean to represent a community? Because does it mean knowing everything and how to lead this community? Or does it mean just sitting down and listening to the community and being that voice that can get the issues out there into the policy circles or the places where the decisions are made?
I think that means a little bit of both of those, actually. Unfortunately, it's impossible for one human being to know everything at all times.
Right.
I don't know. Some people may be out here doing it. I haven't met anybody yet like that. But I feel like as a public servant, if you're going to be a servant leader, you need to know as much as possible that's going on in your community and in the places in which you represent and everything that's going on as much as possible with your constituency, because that's how you're able to be an effective leader, in my opinion, or at least you can understand that, while you may know certain things and there may be limitations to the resources as to how you can advocate for something or actually implement something, you at least know that that's on the horizon.
Right.
Okay, we may not have it right now we may not have the resources to fix this issue, but we know that it's an issue. It's been brought up, it's been made aware, we all are aware that this is an issue, and so the next time when we do have some resources or something, we're going to try to figure it out. I would say that I think that it's a bit of both of it. It's a bit of not necessarily knowing everything, but doing your best to be as informed as possible. And one great example is one of Chicago's most famous mayors, our first black mayor, was Harold Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And he was known for being somebody who not only knew everything, but also was just somebody who was incredibly knowledgeable. And he would sit in a cafe not too far from here every single day and just have all of the newspapers of the world laid out in front of him as he had his morning breakfast.
Wow. Yeah.
And he would look and he would read. So he was as knowledgeable as to everything that was going on in the world and how it would affect him as a leader of this country's third largest city. You know, and I think that that's so important for our leaders to be well-read, well-informed, but more importantly, know the stories and know the people around them and their stories too.
Absolutely. So let's actually track back, because I think we just jumped straight into what it means to be a leader. But I want to talk a little bit more about yourself and how you picked up the reins of being a leader and how you learned how to be a leader. Let's track all the way back. What was your first position of leadership that you remember, and what's that impression that it left on you, that kind of experience?
I guess leadership comes in many, 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 many different forms.
Absolutely.
But I feel like one of the first ways in which I was able to exercise leadership that I didn't know was just being able to use my voice and understanding the power of that. And I got comfortable with using my voice in church choir as a kid and doing spelling bees. But I remember one time when I was asked to do a speech, Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech for our Black History Month program in the fifth grade. That was when I realized that I could use my voice to motivate and inspire people for change. And that was when I kind of took my first path into leadership and said, okay, well, if I know that I can lead people through my voice and right. I'm aware of it and I can use this. And so I ended up running for student government in every single setting from the sixth grade, seventh grade, and eighth grade.
Wonderful.
Lost pretty much every single time. Got to high school and I learned the power of leadership through team building.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because a lot of people think, oh, well, you know, in order to be a leader, you have to always be out in front. You always have to know what's going on. But I was in marching band.
Right.
And my team, we were the trombone team, so we were low brass, so we were in the back of the band.
Oh, wow.
Right? But as a leader within a band, it's not your job to shine more than anybody else.
Hmm.
It's not your job to be louder than anybody else. As a leader, your job is to make sure that you blend in as much as possible so that the band sounds, you know, uniform and put together. And when you have breakout sessions and everything, you can help get the section together as to like what parts are played and how people are supposed to look as we look as uniform as possible. And that was the way that I kind of learned a whole new style of leadership, which was basically like leadership from behind, you know, and it's humbling too, because I think a lot of times when you're in positions where you have a president next to your name or CEO or whatever,
the titles,
it makes
man.
It all fun. Yeah, the yeah. titles, it sounds fun and it seems like it's so great and it's flashy and everything. But what happens when you have a position as a leader where it doesn't necessarily feel as rewarding in terms of just like you being celebrated as this wonderful person? And for band, it was just like if we got accolades, it was accolades as a group.
Yeah,
because we all worked equally as hard, you know, to produce something bigger than ourselves. And that's when I started to see that there was so much leadership skills that you could learn through art, through
Absolutely.
Band, through the
yeah.
arts. And so that kind of inspired the way that I looked at leadership from forever on after that.
Mm. Yeah, I think for me, the similar experience was through dance. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, I was used to being like that center of attention, the debater, the public speaker. And the moment I started taking dance more seriously and started getting into the dance teams, you realize that the point is not to stick out, but it is to be in sync with everybody around you.
Yeah.
And more often than not, that is so much harder than actually being the one that stands out. Because if you know what makes you unique and you know that, you know, maybe being the loudest or being the most different allows you to stick out, but being in sync with 20, 30, and in the case of band, even more people together, it's just something that is so, so difficult. So I totally understand what you're talking about. But also, you know, for those of the people listening to the podcast that don't get an opportunity like that, where they get to experience the beauty of being in sync with teammates or fellow artists, what do you suggest is something that people can look into or try to learn about? Because, as I said, it's so much more difficult to be one amongst the group rather than being the one sticking out. So do you have any words for people that are looking to find that kind of experience?
I would just say continue to look around them and continue to just put it out into the universe, because you never know. Like, oftentimes if you say, like, look, I want to sing or I want to play or I want to do something like that, you never know. You could always find somebody who does something or dance or whatever. So
right.
I think that's one way to do it. Or you could be the one to start it. If you don't know much about it and you want to look up some YouTube videos on how to start a dance or something and you want to get people involved, then go ahead and do it. I just think that it's something that's so powerful and special about, like, you know, this generation in which we live in, where we do have access to, you know, the internet. Many of us do.
Yeah.
And we can look up and we can find different places and different people who inspire us or things that we can learn from or take from, or whether it's team building skills or learning how to just create a group.
Absolutely.
You know, and get people passionate and inspired about something that's much bigger than themselves.
That's so true. But now let's move back to your experiences again. And I want to highlight your college experience, because one of the first things I remember about my college experience is running into you almost on our first day in college.
Mm-hmm.
I ran into Candace, who was living, Candace is his twin sister, Peyton's twin sister. Shout out to Candace. Hi, Candace.
Hey.
I miss you. And we met and on the very first day. And I remember her introducing me to you on that very first day where we talked about Dubai, where we talked about leadership, and we were standing in line to get pizza. But our friendship started from that point on all the way through you becoming the president of the Missouri Students Association, representing the students of the entire university. Let's talk about that journey for you. Stepping into this massive university from after coming in from Chicago, and you know, I have my own experiences of coming in from Dubai, but but let's talk about what was it like to come to this huge university, and then finding your space in a place that's, you know, kind of scary. Thousands of students, lots of things to do, lots of people, some hostile environments. But I'd like to hear your experience about how you found your space and how you were navigating through it.
Yeah, I think I took it as a challenge to make the space my own when I first got there. But it was a little bit difficult. Yeah. It was definitely a culture shock, especially being somebody who's Black in a community that was predominantly white.
Absolutely.
When many of the areas that I've grown up in have been predominantly Black, which is like South Suburbs and South Chicago, all of that. So it definitely was a culture shock getting on campus. It's not to say that like I hadn't been in a space like this before, but I was now living in this space,
right,
and interacting with people almost every single day who look different than me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying I didn't necessarily know how to do that. It was just that it was something that kind of caught me off guard at first because I didn't know like what people would think of me and how they would treat me and how I would be able to find a space in this mass university where it just seemed like so many people were just going every which way and doing every single little thing.
Or
nothing at all. That was the thing, right?
Absolutely.
Some people literally stayed in their room for 4 years and played Call of Duty. And that was what made them happy. But I remember when I first got there, I sought out to make the university much smaller than what it was. And I remember hearing over and over and over that getting involved is what will help you do that. So even before I applied, I mean, even before I got on campus, I was there a week earlier because I joined the Emerging Leaders Program.
Right.
Where I came in with some incoming freshmen a week earlier. And we did some leadership activities throughout the week to like build a network of student leaders on campus, future student leaders on campus. I joined the Mizzou Black Men's Initiative, and that was a really important affinity group space to come in and be with people who look like me, who had similar goals, ambitions, but also to just challenges, you know, with being in that space, just based off of our backgrounds and where we were coming from. So that organization was really, really powerful for fostering a lot of the brotherhood that I was going to feel on campus eventually. And I remember every single day we had an events calendar on our website, the University Activities website, stufftodo.missouri.edu.
I remember that too.
a
website that I definitely frequented.
And I was so busy in high school with band and student council and NHS and all these random things that I got to college and I was just like, what am I supposed to do with all my time? What do you mean I only have 2 hours a day for class?
Right.
Like, 2 hours of class a day. Like, what do you mean? So I took it as an opportunity to sync my calendar with the Stuff to Do calendar. In any and every single university event that was going on, I went. And that's how I was exposed to so many different cultures, so many different religions, so many different backgrounds, so many different causes. And I started to go to all of these different things over and over and over and over and over again. And I realized that by the time I was at my sophomore, junior year, I had known most of the university.
Yeah.
And so many different people around me had had so many different interactions with me that I didn't even know.
Right.
I got a part-time job on campus with Mizzou After Dark, which was our safe alternative to, our sober alternative to going out for a crazy night in town on Friday nights. And so on my Friday nights, I would...
Organizing these incredible events. I remember those from freshman year.
So I was event staff. I would move all the chairs and things around, put the decorations up in the student unions, and then hand out pizza to all the international students. And that's how I met a significant portion of our international students who would come there on Friday nights. And I would talk to them about their experiences, whether coming from different countries and what they were feeling, whether it was loneliness or whether it was happiness or whatever it may be. And that's how I got to meet a whole different population of students. So I started to branch out from a very, very early time on campus, and I started to know so many different communities before I even got to a position of leadership.
That's right. And, you know, I think that comes from like a natural curiosity to understand people and connect with people and be there with people. But at the same time, I'm sure there were certain experiences that didn't feel as welcoming. Because as far as I can remember in my experience being a student at the University of Missouri itself, there were definitely a few places where I didn't feel the most comfortable being me. And the pressure to assimilate was kind of pushed down upon me in certain spaces. You know, I was greatly interested in American politics, but coming in with an accent and trying to interact with individuals that have been working in the space for a long time, you're an outsider. And you tend to be pushed out a little bit just because you don't kind of fit the description of what it means to be an American working in these spaces, or even a foreigner was curious about this. So there were several things about that, but at the same time, making Mizzou home was also one of those things that I think we all as freshmen and sophomore students all strive to do. But I wanted to ask you about what were some of those difficult challenges or difficult experiences that you had in this quest of finding your home at this massive university?
I think the biggest experience was really just like navigating my path in terms of what I was going to do, because there were so many different ways in which I could have taken my time at Mizzou, especially trying to stay rooted in my own community,
right,
build community at the same time, but also like try to figure out like how to make these spaces better so that I could feel home or make a home there.
Sure.
And then I started to think more and more, like I would say, well, you know, there doesn't seem to be a space for me.
Mm.
And I remember my freshman year, I went to the Chancellor's Diversity Initiative conference where they had launched a new initiative, and they had announced a new chief diversity officer, and that all, they were going to be doing all this stuff. And I just remember seeing that they were so excited about this campaign, One Mizzou. But I told the chancellor at this Q&A forum, I said, I don't see One Mizzou. I see 2, 3, 4. I see athletic. I see Greek. I see black. I see white. I see black Greek. I see white Greek. I see so many different factions here.
Mm.
But I don't necessarily see one community interacting with each other.
Right.
And more importantly, I didn't say, like, this is your problem. I said, how can I, you know, make this better?
Sure.
What can I do in my time here? And so they recommended that I get involved with the Chancellor's Diversity Initiative, which I did as a freshman. In addition to, they said, just get involved. And so I took it as a challenge. I'm like, okay, I can get involved.
Yeah.
So I joined any and everything, you know, from the Legion of Black Collegians student government to being the representative for that government, to the Missouri Students Association, to working with the Multicultural Issues Committee and changing it to the Social Justice Committee, and trying to make sure that the social justice centers were more inclusive, because in many different ways I felt like I would hear homophobic things being said in the Black Culture Center, and then, you know, racist things being said in, well, not being said, but like racism being perpetuated in the LGBTQ Resource Center. So it was really trying to get us all as a community to be more intentional about having intersectional conversations around oppression, identity, experience, whatever that may be, because I'm like, at the end of the day, we're one big community. And so we have got to figure out a way to work with each other. My own experience is my sophomore year being called out of my name, which was an experience I didn't necessarily write about, but I took it as a challenge to say, like, I could either transfer, I could leave, I could say that I'm not going to be here anymore, I don't want to be here anymore. But later I realized, I'm like, this is my home. And I'm like, when you have a home, it's not always just as easy to just get up and leave. Right? If your home gets dirty, you clean it up, right? Hopefully. And so that was the mentality that I started to take. And I said, you know what? I'm just going to get more involved and get more of my time of service to educating us on our differences and helping people understand that they can be celebrated too.
Absolutely.
And sometimes in celebrating our differences, you find that there's so many different similarities. Right. And so that's what I did. I became a diversity peer educator. I would speak to fraternities and sororities and different student organizations, and we would have really difficult dialogues about diversity, inclusion, equity, what that all looked like, but more importantly, how we can move forward together. I didn't believe in coming in and pointing this finger at everybody saying, you're a racist, or you're a homophobe, or you're this and that, which a lot of media like tries to depict, you know, social justice people doing. And I'm not saying that there aren't people who don't do that kind of
stuff. Right.
But I just didn't find it helpful. Because I don't think that I would learn if somebody like pointed
just
at me.
Just pointed
the
finger
time.
And accuses you of something. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that gets back to that compassionate leadership. Like, hey, look, like, this is what you did. You perpetuated this system today. This is and this is how this can be hurtful. And this is how this can be dangerous.
Right.
And these are the ways in which we can move forward together so that, you know, we can understand things. And that was the role that I put myself in as a student who was not only a learner, but also a facilitator for other people's learning, too.
Fantastic. And so, you know, you're starting to immerse yourself in all these different communities and causes and starting to be an influential voice in our university. When did that thought come to you that you could represent all the students of the university, that you are the best fit to take the university in the direction forward? Because I believe that another absolutely important characteristic of a leader is to realize that they have the potential, that I have the potential to be a good leader, to be a compassionate leader, to be that authentic leader, to be that voice of reason. So do you have a moment in time during your experience when that came to you, when you realized that you are that leader? Or was it a culmination of several different experiences that led you to believe that you needed to represent the students of this university?
Well, so it was a bit of both. So a lot of it was many different experiences. But I remember one that stood out in particular was when the organization that I worked with, the Social Justice Committee within our student government, won the Coretta Scott King Organization of the Year through the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, NAACP.
Wow. Yeah.
And I wasn't necessarily focused the entire year on just trying to do stuff to be president. I was just focused on doing the work. And that's what I think a lot of people don't understand. Like, if you are starting to meet, like, if you announce that you're running for office and then you start meeting with people and then you start trying to build something, it's like, it's almost too late.
Right.
Like, I feel like...
And I think people would realize that too, right? Like, it's very understandable and recognizable that you're doing it after the fact.
Mm-hmm. And that's what I say. I'm like, if you want to be an elected official, if you want to be a leader, just be a leader.
Mm.
Right? You don't need anybody to give you a fancy title at the end of the day to validate your leadership. You just do it. And that was, I was like, I wanted to be doing the work of a president before I was president.
Right.
And so by the time it was time for elections and even debates, there were already several resolutions that had been put in place through student government that had passed. There were already several meetings that I was having on campus about the implementation of certain things. We had already passed, you know, a resolution through the Joint Senate of Student Governments to include the International Student Council within the joint session of student governments, which was a really big deal as we were trying to figure out ways in which to make sure that international students had more of a voice within all of the student associations and
Absolutely.
All of the student power groups on campus. And so all of this work was being done. And I told people, I'm like, regardless of if I'm president or not, like, I don't have a title next to me and this is getting done. And it wasn't all me, it was a team.
Yeah.
But I think that was something that was critical to me being in office, was I wasn't going to sit up here and BS anybody about what I was going to do because I was doing it already. And my resume showed what I was capable of. And the work was being done long before I got into office, and the work was going to continue to be done. Because people, you know, we had the little gold name tag craze. Everybody was trying to collect them. And, you know, being president is not, like, it was fun, you know, election day. Yeah, this is great. You know, but when you get into office, it's a lot of hard work. And you're dealing with a lot of different issues, and you're taking on that responsibility at a very young age, you know, for handling a lot of systemic issues that are related to any major institution that's in this country.
Right.
So it definitely wasn't easy, but I think that, like, my pathway to leadership showed that I was ready to take up something bigger.
Absolutely. And I still remember, like, even during the debates when and all due respect to everybody else that ran the elections, but it just was like, you could see the difference. You could see the fact that these were individuals that were reading up on all the things that had happened at the university over the last couple of years, while you had lived those experiences helping bring about the kind of systemic change that we all wanted to see in the university. So it was a natural fit for you to go up on stage and talk about like social justice and talk about being making the campus safer and talk about, you know, putting our university on a map. Whereas when somebody else who didn't live those experiences, who didn't put their work behind their word, were talking about those things, it was very easily seen. So I just want to like now kind of transition into the year, because that year was, I don't even have words to describe that year that you were president, because let's start from the very beginning. Right from the start, right before what we'll get to and we'll talk about in just a bit. But I wanna go back to like, you've taken up this massive leadership position. You're still a student. You're trying to balance both at the same time. But at the same time, this is like almost a full-time job. It's a full-time gig. How is this 19, 20-year-old Peyton, who's just been elected into this incredibly important position of power while being a student, while being a young adult, how is he dealing with the pressure? How is he dealing with this opportunity at hand?
Yeah, I think it wasn't, I always talk about the importance of a team, because I don't think that leadership is like even there are now scholars who are talking about how we have to stop having this messianic approach to activism or leadership in general, because it makes it seem like there's not a team behind somebody, right? And my team was everything for me. My communications team was everything. Student services, student activities, my vice president, like everybody on my cabinet, like literally was everything to me. And so I didn't necessarily feel all of the burden of, you know, trying to navigate and run this whole association by myself, because I wasn't doing it by myself. I had help and I had a team and I had good people behind me who were always looking out for me and who were always making sure that I would be successful in whatever endeavors I took on as president. And I think that was the key, the major key. Because yes, it was a lot. It was a lot going on, but I think it would have been even worse to try to handle all of that if I was doing it by myself, if I didn't have an incredible team behind me, if I didn't have, you know, allies across campus who were rooting for me, if I didn't have random students every single day who would come up to me and say, like, hey, we believe in what you're doing. We believe in you, and we believe in the way in which you're taking our institution, our school. All of that played a role in helping me keep my head up every single day and do the best that I can.
Absolutely. And there again is the mark of a true leader when you absolutely give credit where it's due to your incredible team that you had. And again, so often leaders forget that there is an entire army of individuals that are holding them up in their position of leadership and allowing them to do the best that they can by doing their own bits right behind the leader. We'll move straight into probably the most definitive experience that you had as a leader at the university. And I actually want you to do the talking, because it was an experience that you lived through. It was an experience that you went through, especially following what happened in Ferguson. So if you can describe that with the understanding that some of the audience that's listening to this might not be as aware about whatever went down at our university. So if you can give us a broad sweep about what actually happened and your experience and your role in it as well.
Yeah. So there was a lot that happened. I could talk about it for hours and hours.
Right.
But I think at the core of it, it was just a change that was happening, a big shift that was happening, not only at Mizzou, but also in the nation,
the country,
as we were actually starting to open our eyes to racism and its harmful effects of what that looks like for our society. And I think the hardest part was just like a lot of people just weren't ready to have that conversation, especially within spaces of higher education, because at the time, this was 2014, 2013, people had really thought that we were past a lot of these different issues. People thought that Obama's presidency, especially, you know, in the academy, represented
the shift
to a post-racial society, when in many ways that just wasn't the case. I think the events that happened in Ferguson definitely played a role in inspiring the activism of students on campus at the University of Missouri when they started to talk about like institutional structures, when they started to talk about institutional racism, systemic racism, and structural violence that plays a role within a lot of institutions all across this country, just based on the nature as to how this place was built. You have a whole nation that was built from sea to shining sea on the genocide of one people and the slavery, chattel slavery of another.
Yeah.
And that plays a big role in how we navigate all of our institutions today. And our collective memory as a nation is very, 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 very small. So many of us think that we all just ended up here one day and everything was all fine and dandy, but that wasn't how it went down. And there were still so many battles for freedoms and rights that are still ongoing today. It doesn't mean that America is a bad place, but it just means that we're always being aspirational about where we can take the future of our nation so that it can be better and serve all of her citizens to the best of its ability.
For sure.
And getting back to what happened in Ferguson, that was just, it showed how much work still has to be done when Michael Brown was killed by the police in Ferguson. And I think the one thing that was really, really hurtful, but also irresponsible on behalf of an institution of higher learning, was for them to not talk about these experiences.
Kind of push it under the rug.
To sweep it under the rug, to make it seem like we don't play a role in systemic violence ourselves.
Mm.
And to also not use it as a way to have an academic conversation about ways in which to move our society forward.
Right.
I think our university president at that time, well, following the movement, Mike Middleton said it best. He said at the National Press Club, what if we used universities as the hospitals to cure racism?
Wow.
Because universities are supposed to be about enlightenment, right?
Right.
And education.
And so yet we're not talking about all these issues that are absolutely crucial to being, you know, to being a member of this incredibly cosmopolitan society that we're living in these days.
Yeah. And so those were the conversations that students started to pressure the university to have. And I remember being at the very first demonstration led by incredible women of color, queer women of color, who were just like, we are here for Mike Brown, and we are standing up for this, and we're also calling out this institution as well for its own injustices that it perpetuates, that play a role in situations like this happening all across America when people aren't educated on these issues, when you have business students who aren't understanding the effects of what it means to deal with diverse communities and how capitalism and economics plays a role in the suppression and the oppression of different voices and different peoples.
Right.
When you have nursing and medical students who aren't having any classes that talk about diversity, but, you know, we're having this larger national conversation, international conversation on the reproductive health of Black women.
Right.
And how bias plays a role into how you're treated in many different ways at healthcare facilities. So these are a lot of the conversations that were happening on campus that kind of played a role in the movement becoming larger than what it was.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to so many different things happening on campus, because this gets back to students having an issue with the university and how they addressed when cotton balls were put in front of the Black Culture Center
a couple of years ago.
And, you know, the university said, well, this is just littering. We're charging these students with littering. Or when the N-word was spray painted on a statue in front of one of the residence halls, when you have a swastika drawn in feces, when you have all of these different symbols of hate being put up and not condemned by the university, it started to become a larger issue as to what are our values as an institution. Because if we say we value excellence, responsibility, discovery, and respect, are those representative of the core values of this institution? If they're not, then we need to have a conversation about who belongs here and what they represent.
Absolutely.
And so this played a larger role. And that year was challenging in so many different ways.
And you had a personal experience too, if I'm not mistaken, that very year. And if you're comfortable talking about it, because I remember reading about it and just being completely appalled.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, your post obviously went viral and sparked a massive conversation and movement at the university. But at the core of it, for me as a student, you know, at this university, away from home, thousands of miles away from home, realizing that my friends were being targeted through hate by mm-hmm. other people that are part of this community that we were calling home, this whole idea of this one university, one Mizzou, mm-hmm. and yet realizing that there was so much hate that was still within people. It was shocking, and it was scary to just watch it from the sidelines. And I can't even imagine what it was to go through that and be attacked yourself. If you can talk about that a little bit as well, and how it shaped your role in this movement as well.
Well, like I said, this was the second time, this incident where, you know, it was more students on the back of a pickup truck calling me the N-word. This was the second time that it had happened. But this time was different because I was president. And I decided that I was going to speak out about it because I felt really powerless because I felt like I'd been doing so much work on campus with the Social Justice Committee, with diversity peer educators, that I was giving up so much time to addressing these issues and talking about these issues and having difficult dialogues and critical conversations or whatever you want to call it. And it just felt like it was just missing a whole population of people on campus. And the one thing that kind of scared me is just like people graduating, you know, from my institution, the same, you know, degree that I have,
still
and going out into the world and having such a profound ignorance of the people around them and the spaces in which they inhabit every single day, that bothered me. And that to me showed that not only would the university be failing them in many ways, but our society is failing them by like not helping them understand a truer story of what's going on and what and how we are the way we are today. And so the second time it happened, I wrote about it on Facebook. And it was more just a call to action to the community.
Right.
Just like, look, y'all, like, this is what it is. It's nothing personal, but it is personal.
But it definitely is personal.
It's just
personal,
like, look, like, because the thing is what happened to me happens to people all the time.
Every single day, almost,
The only thing that made this different was because of the title that I had next to my name.
Student body
and
president.
When I made the post about, you know, the incident, in addition to saying, like, this kind of stuff happens to my friends who are Muslim and who wear hijabs and are called towelheads and terrorists, or when my one friend who's trans who was spit on walking down 9th Street, these incidents of hatred, they exist. But more importantly, to me, I wasn't so upset with the actual perpetrators of these incidents, right? What I was more concerned with was the people around in every single situation who see situations like this happen and don't say anything.
Right, right.
Because that means that, like, that silence is compliance. And when people have, when people feel emboldened to do acts like that because nobody around them is going to check them, nobody around them is going to say, hey, like, what you did is not okay, like, whatever it may be. It starts to create a dangerous society for all types of people.
For sure.
Because when it's you, you would hope that somebody would speak out for you. You know, and so that's what I started to call a community to do. It's just like, if you see something, if you say something, and that's how we're all going to be better. Because I remember for the incident that happened to me, it was multiple boys who were sitting on that truck. And I'm not saying that all of them agreed with what was happening and what was being said.
They didn't speak up.
But they didn't say anything at the time. And that to me just let me know, it's just like, wow, like, you're like, the silence is louder than the person actually screaming at me. And that was my call to action, was to, for the university community, it was to wake up. I told people, it's time to wake up, Mizzou. It's time to hold your fraternity brothers, sorority sisters accountable, your friends, your family members, whoever it may be that is close to you in your life, who you see doing things like this every single day, hold them accountable.
Right.
Right? Because that's ultimately what's going to make us better as a society, at least in my opinion. And I think a lot of people agreed. it was interesting to see a post like that go viral because I didn't necessarily think that it was something worthy of going viral. I just thought that it was a simple message to the community to just wake up. But it went to the Washington Post.
Yeah.
And they wrote about it. They said what the student body president did after he was called the N-word and blah, 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 blah. And this and that. And I just wanted every single journalist who was in and out of my office that year to know, like, you weren't there because this happened to me, because it happens to students all the time. You were there because it happened to somebody with my title. And that's when I started to really understand the importance of having a platform. And when you have a platform, understanding the privilege that comes with that. And when you have a platform, you know, and you have privilege on which you stand, I think that you have a responsibility, a greater responsibility, to make things better for the people coming after you, or elevate the voices of those who aren't heard. And that's how I've been trying to use my platform to this very day.
Yeah, and what did it feel like at that point where suddenly there was just so much, not just regional attention on you, but national attention, and via you on our university and this incredible dialogue that was happening on campus? How did, again, you know, it just blows my mind that somebody was so young at that time. Not that you're old right now, but at that time, having cameras put on your face, being subject to hate almost on a daily basis on Twitter, on Facebook, on all these social media, because trust me, I saw some of those things that people were posting. Mm-hmm. And by association, I had people from around the world that were in my networks come, like, reaching out to me and asking me, what the hell is going on? How are you connected with this guy? What's happening? And if by association I was, you know, being bombarded with questions, I can't imagine what it was like to go through that experience being you. So if you can talk about that a little more as well, and also address the fact about how you handled it, because I think there's a big lesson for all of us to learn, because when I was watching the videos that were being published of you speaking on these issues, I just always noticed how poised and calm, yet at the same time, straight to the point you were. And I can only imagine that it takes so much courage and at the same time a lot of strength to be in a position like that and be so calm and speak so lucidly about the issue at hand.
Well, I think that that's where I get back to, like, having a team was so important. Because there were spaces to cry, there were spaces to heal and all that. And then there was time for business because we had a bigger cause that was in front of us. That time was extremely hard in my life. A lot of it has been blotted out, really, because it was just extremely traumatic. I felt like I saw the absolute worst of America.
Yeah.
Down to its core, down to its ugly, ugly, ugly core. And I did not expect in 2015 that kind of hatred was out there.
Right.
I just didn't know. Mm-hmm. I think I was ignorant, and I think that in many ways it was like a coming of age for me to realize that, like, hey, you know, not everybody's rocking with you. Not everybody's down for this whole diversity inclusion thing. Not everybody's down for equality, because a lot of people have this idea that in order for there to be more equity in this country, that everybody else is going to have to give up something. And that means that if you're super privileged, that you won't have your status anymore, or you think that all these different people want something from you because they didn't work hard enough for it. But we turn our backs on having conversations about, like, generations and generations of exploitation. So it was just so much that I think was revealed to me in that time that truly just opened my eyes to truly what we're up against. And some of the ideologies and beliefs of people in this nation. But I would say on the same side, on the same coin, I would say the other side of that was just seeing the beauty in understanding that we were not alone.
Right.
The amount of love and support that poured in from students at universities all across the world, it meant so much because it helped counter this narrative. Because I always thought back in the day, I mean, I was young and naive. I thought that, you know, you could trust the news and that the news was a good source. And, well, not all of it, but like certain outlets that, you know, they would be getting your story out, objection, you know, and making sure that it was as accurate as possible. And then I realized, like, all these news companies had motivations just based off of like the ways in which they clip the videos and the talking points for some of us who were speaking, or the titles that they would give the segments that they would put on about us, or
they almost control the narrative if you think about it.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It was very much and that's one of the reasons why I talk about the importance of having real conversations about like diversity and inclusion within like media representation, because you know, history is his story, right? And history a lot of times is written by the victor. And now this movement was so instrumental in shaping modern day movements, because we had something that our ancestors didn't have, and that was the ability for everybody to be a storyteller if they wanted to. We all had cell phones, right? We could all tweet, we could all Facebook share, we could do whatever we could to let people know that this is what is really happening here. And when the news, you know, tried to make this narrative that these Mizzou students were just coddled whiners, and that this, all these incidents at Mizzou, they were single isolated incidents, and that Missouri was a hotbed. There was one article, I think it was the New York Times or Chronicle or whoever, that said that Mizzou was a hotbed of racial harassment. And that was one of the most ignorant, like, articles. I was just like, who wrote this? That was the biggest thing. I was thinking, like, who was allowed to write something like this?
Because on a major publication.
On a major publication that shows the level of ignorance in these staff rooms as when people talk about these types of issues. You say Mizzou is a hotbed of racial... Mizzou is a hotbed of racial harassment because the whole country is a hotbed of racial harassment.
Exactly.
And I think that every single student who rose up in support all across the country, they countered that narrative with that the media was putting out, this mainstream media was saying that it was all just a Mizzou issue. And you had students saying like, hey, this is an issue here at University of Alabama, Birmingham. This is an issue here at Yale University.
Yeah.
This is an issue here at UChicago. This is an issue here at University of Nevada, and all of these different states all across the country, in addition to international universities and students coming in and saying like, this happens here too. Let's talk about it. We want it to be better. These are our demands. That meant the world, and it showed how much the media needs to change and how much there's a need for diverse voices and diverse writers and diverse storytellers within these major publications.
Wow. Yeah, and I feel like another aspect of this, and you just briefly mentioned, is that history is written by the victor. And in our case, in the University of Missouri's case, we were fortunate that the movement that you and I and all of us were a part of was eventually successful in at least at that time, bringing about the change that we were talking about, that we were pushing for, and standing up against something as immovable as the school institution.
Mm-hmm.
Here we were fighting that battle, and in many ways, we won. And what was that feeling when you saw the administration respond to some of the demands and communicate that? And I know, you know, ultimately we didn't get all the demands met, but there was change that at least was initiated. And if you can talk about that as well.
I guess it was difficult because it was still... I thought in many ways that like addressing the demands would like help like me feel better in many different ways, but it was so much bigger than that. I think that there's still a level of trauma that exists there. Even when I go back to school, I remember I just spoke at Mizzou, I think in March this year.
Right.
And it was hard. It was really, really difficult, you know, to get on stage and form the words as to what I wanted to say to the community, because there's still much that has to be done there. And a lot of us who go there and like who were involved, they still feel the trauma and the pain of what it meant to be back on campus in those days. But it also feels weird because it also still feels like home.
Right.
And that's the thing that would get me. I think it's just like this interesting relationship that a lot of us have, not only with Mizzou, but just like with the nation around us, you know, that there's so much that like needs to be changed and done. but at the end of the day, it's still home.
Yeah.
And so there's a responsibility, it almost feels like, to try to leave it better for the people who come after us. So I guess that was kind of like my mindset. That's kind of how I was feeling as the demands were being addressed. When the resignations happened, I wasn't a big cheerful person. Because while other people could cheer, I was still president, which meant that I had to handle all of the institutional backlash from the legislature and all that, like, for this happening. And that was the first time when I felt the most unsafe that I have ever felt unsafe in my life. Because the same day as the resignations, a lot of people don't know, because media didn't really cover that, like they should have, was when death threats came to campus. When somebody said that they were going to stand their ground and shoot every last Black student on campus. And I was concerned about that from the moment of the resignations, was the fact that any times that there's, I remember my history teacher used to always say, anytime that there's a liberal action, there's a conservative reaction, right?
Yeah.
I was waiting for that reaction, and I didn't expect it to be a threat of violence over Black students exercising their right to protest on campus. As much as we, now there's such a conversation about First Amendment rights on campus, but that was really, really, I guess it was really saddening to see at the time, and just scary in general.
Right. I can't even fathom what it means to be going through that experience, because in many ways, a school, a place like Mizzou, which again, you're supposed to feel safe at home. And as you beautifully put, the juxtaposition between home versus all these feelings of, you know, the concerns about safety, the concerns about your personal space, and the concerns of other people's spaces, and at the same time being a representative and a voice for other students, yet being a target because of that very reason, must have been just an absolutely, like, a completely difficult and, well, here's my question, because I've been wanting to know about this. How did you go back after all this happened to school and still feel like that was home on a daily basis? I'm sure you were just on alert, you know, just checking all sides and thinking about all these things that are going on, but you still were a student. There were classes you had to attend.
It felt really surreal. It felt like, I don't know, I think a lot of times people don't really appreciate, you know, this kind of work and trauma that is put in as a result of it until years and years and years and years, decades afterwards, right?
Yeah.
I think at the time people were still trying to figure out what this meant and their place in it. So it was challenging. I remember at one point I was going to go back home to Chicago, and I said I was going to finish on Mizzou online after being harassed in a restaurant in downtown Como. I was just like, I can't do this anymore. Like, I've given literally my all every single day. I get up, I come to work, I come to office. Even when everybody had checked out, even when the other activists had, like, checked out, I couldn't, because I made a commitment to the students that I was going to finish up all year. And that's exactly what I did. And then some, when the elections went bad and I had to be thrown back into office, when the slate that was coming after me cheated in the election. So it was extremely challenging. And then it was challenging to work with an administration that still in many ways didn't seem like they were taking student input into account like they should be. And there were so many different recommendations that I made. I'm like, this is what you can do. This is how you do it. And I did it. I'm like, I'm doing this because I love this school and I love the people who are here.
Right.
You know, and I know all the little young Black freshmen coming from Chicago and Detroit and Denver and all that, like, they look up to me, and I can't leave this worse than how I found it, right? I have to leave it better, which means that I'm staying here, and we're going to continue to have these conversations, and we're going to continue to make sure that these initiatives are put in place. We're going to continue to make sure that these demands are being met, you know, and that was the way that I saw it. I said I made a responsibility through thick and thin to be president of this student association, and it wasn't going to run itself. So that was my role throughout it. Because MSA was huge. It had almost 1,000 members in it, you know, and we still had day-to-day operations. We still had activities going on, you know, with the students and campus activities every single day. It was still a functioning institution, a functioning university. That meant that the student government needed to do the same.
Wow.
And that was not the time for the student government to lose power. If anything, that was time for us to build up and have even more of a voice in saying how we want to rebuild the university after all of this. And what we want the university to look like, and what we want student impact, and what we want student voice to look like after that. So I wish I could say everything was peachy keen and perfect. But it wasn't. But I will say I did everything that I could.
You absolutely did.
I will say that I tried my best. And I know I wasn't perfect at all, but I did try my best. Because I knew that it was always something bigger than me.
Absolutely. And there's no doubt that, and as I said, you know, every time I mention your name to a friend or to somebody that I went to school with, it's that exactly that feeling that all of us go through, because you left a legacy that cannot be tarnished over time. And no matter how difficult it was for you at that time, you paved the way for the university to be better, for students to feel like their voice can be heard in spite of all the challenges that are put up against them. And most of all, I think it's a time in the world, not just in the United States, not just in India, not just in China or around the world, that we need inspiration in our leadership. And this is not me saying all this to you just because I have you on the show or just because you're a good friend of mine, but you know how I feel about it. And I feel deeply about the fact that you are an inspiration for all of us, and everything you've done for the university over time is only going to reflect this sacrificial servant leadership that you embodied. And I'm proud that I can call you a friend. And most importantly, I'm proud of the fact that you've impacted thousands of students directly and indirectly for years to come. But I want to move on now, and I know I've been taking a lot of your time, but I just want to, your journey in being a leader, being that voice that's standing up to change communities and schools and societies, did not end with your time at the University of Missouri. In fact, you dove straight in, right into the core of all these issues right after university. If I'd gone through an experience like that, I know that I would have said to myself that, hey, I need some time off. I need a big vacation. I need to recover. First, I just want to ask you, did you take any steps to ensure that you were taking care of yourself after this entire experience that you went through? And two, what made you want to dive straight into your next journey, which was, again, addressing all these? If you can talk about both of those.
Well, honestly, it was just trying to figure out, like, what I knew how to do and what I could do best.
Yeah.
I didn't take the time to heal. I've still, the past 2-3 years have been extremely difficult, still trying to cope with a lot of that trauma. Because I feel it. And I feel like it's something that I will always feel, I will always keep with me. But, like, there's ways in which that, you know, I can navigate it and I can and spend that trauma and empower myself as I empower others.
Right.
And that's one of the ways in which I've been able to kind of heal or work to heal through all of this. I dove straight in, like you said. I moved straight to D.C., and work with the National Campus Leadership Council, where we worked on a lot of these issues at the national level, and provided toolkits for students as they were trying to address not only racial issues on campus, but sexual assault prevention, college affordability, whatever it may be. And then after my fellowship finished, I was still living in D.C., and I was based in D.C., and I went on a speaking tour. And I traveled to universities all across the nation,
amazing,
from University of Alabama to University of Alaska.
Wow.
And I talked with students about some of my experiences that I had at Mizzou. I did workshops with them on leadership development, leadership training, inclusion training, how to recognize intersectionality within your organizations, how to effectively communicate with others. Like I said, communication was a big part of my platform.
Yeah.
Communication was a big part of my leadership on campus. Because even when I wasn't perfect, I would always communicate with people. I'm like, hey, this is what the situation is.
Right.
I said, if I'm asking for 100% transparency from university leadership, you need to get 100% transparency from me.
Hmm.
And I think that always holding yourself accountable before trying to hold other people accountable is one of the biggest strategies of leadership, because people think that you're missing out on something, or you appear weak when you say that you're wrong or you mess up or whatever it may be.
Mm-hmm.
And I honestly think that that is what makes you appear to be stronger, because it shows that you're human. And I think that we all, hopefully, we want human leadership.
Absolutely.
Until maybe we get some AI. I don't know what's going on. I don't think I
would want we don't know AI. What that might look human. Like. And I feel like until we get to a point in which we know, I think it's most important to have the best kind of human leadership that we can. And so I mean, we started off talking about leadership, and we mm-hmm. identified a few key aspects of what makes a good leader. But while we start to wind all this down, our conversation down, I want to try and understand what do you see are the characteristics that make an ideal millennial leader? See, ultimately, we are the present, and we're mm-hmm. going to be the future leaders of countries, of the world. And what does it take to be a strong, ideal millennial leader?
That's a great question. I would say one of the number one things that I've talked about would definitely be being a communicator.
Mm.
I think that's number one. Learning how to effectively communicate, whether it's through speech, whether it's through writing, whether it's through social media, which is one of the biggest ways in which we communicate with the world. I think that's important for a good leader.
Yeah.
I think charisma is extremely really important.
Absolutely.
But that's not always something that can be, you know, learned. But I think that charisma definitely helps with people's perception of you and their ability to learn how to trust you.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to all of that, I think empathy is going to be extremely important in moving forward. We need empathetic leaders. We need people to understand these issues. I would say, I guess I'll do two more. Intersectional.
Mm.
For people to understand that, like, all of our identities, like, they matter, and they affect the ways in which we view the world, right? And the way in which we view the world plays a big role in how we view policy, how we make laws, how we implement laws based off of our own views of the world. I mean, we're seeing that right now in America, mm-hmm. like with President Trump. He has a very specific way in which he views certain people in the world, and he's acting on that through the lens of policy and law. And I think that millennials have to be understanding of that. Like, you have to be intersectional in your leadership. I'm not saying to be like him or anything, of course not. But
I guess we can all agree on that.
Intersectionality will play a role in understanding these identities, and these stories will play a role in good leadership.
Got it.
And then I think the last thing would be to be, I guess, creative.
Mm.
I think that creativity is something that is always downplayed in all of the circles of power.
Right.
Because people think creatives, oh, you just want to go and you want to paint a picture somewhere, or, you know, like you can dance, or yeah, you can sing a little bit, or you can, you know, you can play, whatever it may be. I think that creativity in general is downplayed. And I think that at the core of it, we have to look at what the word creativity means when you get to the core of the world, mm-hmm. create, right?
Yeah.
We need creators. We need people who are going to be looking at the society that we have, in which we have right now, and understanding that it's not going to be sustainable unless we have creative people with creative minds and engineering and all these kind of things, and policy making and every single thing, being creative and saying, look, let's try something we haven't tried before. maybe this will work.
Right.
This whole idea of a Green New Deal, like, nobody was talking about that.
No one was.
But that's creativity right there. To, like, come up with some type of a package that is encompassing that can help us actually combat one of the biggest issues that is affecting our nation and our world right now. We need people who are going to be creative about its implementation. We need people who are going to be creative about, you know, working with policymakers, talking to policymakers, lawyer, whatever it may be, to truly change things and change the way that we live and make them sustainable. And that's not going to come from doing the same thing over and over and over again. We're going to need people out there creating the world in which we all eventually want to live in. And so I think that's going to be crucial for millennial leadership. I think that through all of that, like, yes, communication and all that will play a role with creativity too. Because we are creative in the ways in which we communicate. I think it's creative for us to have all these different platforms that we have, like Twitter, Facebook, whatever it may be. I don't think people imagine that would be a way of legitimate communication back in the day.
And here, like, you have the president and my prime minister using that as one of the primary modes and sometimes the only modes of communicating with the press and the people. Which is remarkable in its own way when you think about it, because how quickly has times have changed so much so that the president can stay up at night, wake up at 3 in the morning or whatever it is, and start communicating directly to the people. And no matter what the content, it's just remarkable to think that that kind of medium is even possible. But right now, you're a student at the Chicago Harris School. I mean, there is, how do I put this right? I think there is just the world that's just open to you to do anything and everything that you want because everybody's screaming out for a leader like you. What is it that Peyton Head wants to do moving forward?
That's a really great question. I think right now I'm still in the position where I feel like I still have so much more to learn about the ways in the world, the ways in which the world operates, which was one of the reasons why I wanted to come not only back to my hometown, because I think that learning happens inside and outside of the classroom. And I think that Chicago is an incredible case study for many different world cities, from the issues that are affecting it that play a big role in what is affecting the nation. And also to get an international context. So I've been doing a lot of different international travel to learn more about the different situations and conflicts around the world and how they play a role here. Just recently got back from Palestine with the University of Chicago, law students and policy students went. And so it was an incredible way to see the lens of the conflict from a different side. Because the first time I was there, I went on.
And right on the ground, too.
Yeah. So those are things that I'm learning about. I work with the Obama Foundation scholars, and so it's 25 students representing 25 countries from around the world, and I'm learning so much from them. I may be going to Switzerland in 2 weeks to the UN to work with the International Decade for People of African Descent for one of their final meetings and see what's going on there and how partnerships can be created across the world for a lot of these different issues that we're talking about in the U.S. Mm-hmm. So I think that for now, I've been really trying to be intentional about looking at the world from a global lens, because the more and more as media, as social media and everything spreads, the more and more we advance as societies, we're also heavily globalizing. And I think that it's not simply enough to be some policymaker or lawyer or politician or whatever you want to be, or leader, whatever it is, and not be knowledgeable about the experience of those in the countries surrounding us and not even surrounding us. I think that more importantly, we have to be global minded when we talk about a lot of these different issues, because things like climate change, issues like that, that's not just going to affect the, you know, the
continent. We're all going to face the brunt of it together.
I was just learning from an incredible scholar from, she's a professor of law, Maxine Burkett at the University of Hawaii. And she was talking about what that means, you know, for vulnerable communities and who is going to be affected the most. There'll be vulnerable communities, communities of colors, that will be affected the most by some of the devastating effects to come of climate change. So those are things that are on the horizon for me, different issues that I'm looking at. Like I said, I enjoy working with students. I enjoy learning from students. And so, yeah, I'll be keeping you posted to what's next. I imagine this time next year I'll be doing something completely different. But I know and I hope that it will always be in the service of others.
Absolutely, brother. One last thing. What's a book that you're reading, music you're listening to, if anything you would like to suggest to our audience and recommend from your side? We are all ears, my friend.
Okay, so I've been horrible with reading because I've been in school, so everything has kind of been school related. So
and
I've been
reading a lot of reading in school.
Yeah, I've been reading UN papers. but one book that I was reading was Becoming by Michelle Obama.
Yes, and, I need to get my hands on that. Yeah.
It's really, really good so far. Music that I'm listening to. I've been listening to City Girls a lot. I don't know if you heard of that.
I have, yes.
Okay.
Yes. I'm with you, my friend. With you.
I know sometimes you need a little.
You just need a little bit of Peyton's moving his shoulders right now. So,
yeah, you know, he's a little twerk, ain't never hurt nobody.
He's a global leader that can throw it down on the dance floor as well.
I try my best, you know. And then, what else? What was the last question?
No, I mean, I just, any recommendations? Okay. Yeah, you got it done. One last thing, actually, and I'd like to end on this. I think, what's one thing that's keeping you up at night these days? I've had answers ranging from a meme through, like, serious global issues, so your answer can be anything.
One thing that's keeping me up at night lately, well, number one, all these emails from my boss. But honestly, that's always been kind of my saving grace, is I sleep. Like, no matter what, I have the kind of body that will not function without sleep. Uh-huh. So, like, I was even if I'm at a party or whatever, I will fall asleep. Like, that. Like I will know when it's time to go, because this body will say it's time to go to sleep, Peyton. So there aren't many things that keep me up at night, because Pepe will be knocked out.
Yeah, no, because you have so many things keeping you up during the day, so I'm pretty sure your body needs that rest at night.
Yeah, and I try to separate all of the issues of the world and everything before when I go to bed, because I feel like I always love the saying that you can't fill from an empty cup. So if I'm up worried about every single thing, and then I try to go to work the next day and try to address all these different things, and I have no sleep, and I have nothing to give of myself to the issues in which I say that are important to fight for, then I'm not of service to anybody.
Yeah.
Right? So I think that that's part of self-care, and self-care is a revolutionary act. Like, yeah, you can be selfless. Yeah, you can be a public servant. You can be of service to others. But if you don't make sure that you're good first, you can't do anything for anybody else.
On that note, Peyton, thank you so much, brother. This was absolutely a pleasure to have you on board.